Senate Finance Committee meeting will come to order. Today is February the 29th, leap year, so today's a special day. Today we have with us the co-chairman, Senator Stedman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, and Senator Dyson. We have three bills up today, and I'll be chairing the meeting for the first one, Senate Bill 256, which is the supplemental and capital appropriations. Then we'll take an at ease, and then we will take up the House Bill, retirement system liabilities, bonds, and corporations. And the final bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 229, Tanana Valley Forest and Minto Flats Refuge. If anyone has any cell phones, I'd advise them to turn them off at this time. We will be the first bill is the supplemental. We'll be hearing it for the first time today and having a presentation on what has been included in the legislation and the modifications. And then we will have any questions that members have. So this is the third hearing that we're having on the supplemental. Any questions, Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd appreciate knowing if you're planning on moving any of these bills today.
The first one we don't plan on moving. This is the first hearing on the supplemental. Senator Stedman will be chairing the meeting on the other two. Do you have any comments on the other two, Senator Stedman?
We're going to have more information brought forward on the pension obligation bond issue dealing with the retirement fund. We'll be holding that bill for further work. The final bill dealing with Minto Flats, I'll be asking for the will of the committee at the end.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, with that, at this time, I would like to call Tim Grusendorf to go over the legislation, CS for Senate Bill 256. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Grusendorf, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. In your packet, you should have a copy of the CS /C. You should have a spreadsheet that looks something like this, colored, that we'll be going through. You should also have a couple of sheets from Ledge Finance that gives you the overall department breakdowns on funding. So there's two of those, a two-pager and a one-pager that looks something like that, that we'll be going through. We'll start with this colored sheet that you have, and we'll just run down. I'm not going to go over the ones that the governor proposed and that we haven't changed. We went over those when the administration made their presentation. So we will turn to page, I believe it will be page 7 of 18. At the bottom two items on the page, you'll lines 72 and 73. I'll start with line 72. Natural resources, oil and gas. That one was modified, and because some of those folks hadn't been hired yet, the number was reduced from 110,000 to 85, and we believe at this point that should cover, if they get those people online and hired, that this amount should cover them through the end of the fiscal year. The next line 73, public safety, that is the same thing. We've reduced that down because those folks have, to our knowledge, have not been hired yet, and we believe this number will cover them, the ones that they are able to hire prior to the end of the fiscal year. Okay, on page 8 at the top, environmental conservation, water quality. This has to deal with the Ocean Ranger program. We modified the language, and that was just to make sure everyone understands that this program spends no more than the $4 birth tax that it generates. So we don't want them spending, anticipating more funds and spending above what they receive. Next item, line 75, education. That was to finish up. There was a, the governor had proposed, it has a three-year, had a three-year plan for these incentive, performance incentive program, and this will fund that program so we can let them finish that out, so we can get a report from them to see if that program, you know, works to how we thought it might. So that, that just allows them to finish up and make the payments to those folks that they're anticipating sending that out to. Transportation, line 76. I am not sure how we modified that one. I might have to have Amanda or someone from Ledge Finance come up and explain that one, but I can, we can come back to that one.
Okay.
Line 77, the PCE fund. What we did is we bumped the number up to from 700,000 GF to 1,200,000, and that, and then we're going to draw down the, for the following year, we're going to reduce their 09 request by 500,000 to finish up, so we can make the payments to fully fund PCE for fiscal year 08. Okay, line 78. This is a new appropriation, and this line will be dependent on the passage of SB 125, which is the PERS bill. This will pay for the heroes list that we're all familiar with, and also those that were at the time under the current rate of 22%. This will be a one-time payment to those folks to get them up to 22%. Before, in the 125, there was kind of a phase up for them to get them up to 22%, and that language is fairly cumbersome. So if 125 passes, that language will be removed from SB 125, and it'll be a one-time payment to the heroes and those folks that were in under 22%. Line 79, this is the, we are taking this tax, the vehicle rental tax, and we're gonna put it into what is now gonna be in line 84, parks management. That was funds that were not appropriated yet, and we're gonna give that to the parks management for their use. Line 80, 100 for revenue sharing. That'll be contingent on the passage of SB 72. That's 150 million for the capitalization of the new revenue of the new fund for revenue sharing. If the bill passes, that will be the amount to capitalize that fund, so we can begin the draw for revenue sharing. Line 81, the Anchorage Hatchery. This is a scope change that for the time is just removing it's removing the funding for the Fairbanks side of that, because there's some questions out there on some of the cost overruns, and it's going to be up for discussion at some point, but we want to make sure that we don't get too far ahead of ourselves in that project without understanding what the costs are going to be to the state. Line 82 is a part of the savings plan. It's a deposit to the statutory budget reserve of $1 billion. Line 83 is along those same lines, a part of the savings plan, an appropriation of $2.6 billion to the constitutional budget reserve. Line 84 is, we talked about that earlier, it's the money that was transferred for the vehicle tax will be transferred to this line in natural resources for parks management. Line 85, shared taxes and fees. This is part of the money is there, and it was in the 09 budget, and there's the people that are supposed to be receiving these funds have not been able to receive them, and this will allow them to receive the money that's supposed to be coming to them. So we're taking it out of 09, we're putting it in 08, so we can get this money out to the people that have it coming to them. Line 86, Alaska Housing Finance Committee. This is to the Department of Revenue. This is part of an energy program that that the legislature wants to start down that path. It's for to the Alaska Housing Energy Efficiency and Weatherization Program. And on the next page, in the top line to revenue, is a $100 million that is going to the same department for the Alaska Housing Home Energy Rating Rebate Program. Line 88 is a capital project placeholder for $50 million. And line 89 is a, last year there was a few appropriations made in LMR to LMR, ACPAY, and the phone system. And we use that master lease line of credit for as a revenue source, I think we made a mistake there, and we should not have allowed that to happen. So what we're doing is replacing that funding source with general funds, because we don't anticipate using the master lease line of credit as a funding source for projects like this. And then you can see at the bottom of page 9, the total projects that were deleted that we have not addressed yet in this that the governor had proposed, which is $32,435,000. The approved items that the governor requested are $172 million. And so as you go across that page, you can see the amount that the Senate has added, including their savings, to the supplemental.
Amanda,
yes.
The item
76, please. Okay. I'm not sure what that is.
Please identify yourself for the record and give us an explanation of item 76.
For the record, I'm Amanda Ryder with Legislative Finance. Mr. Chairman, line 76 was that modification that was included in this was because EPA has filed, I guess, an enforcement action against the state, and this money was appropriate or was requested for legal action to collect evidence and present a defense. But the modification that this bill has in the language enables the state to pay settlement costs. So it just adds settlement costs to the language.
Thank you. With that, I would entertain a motion for the adoption of the CS. Senator Stedman?
I'd like to go ahead and move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill 256, Finance Version C, Kane, dated 2/29/08.
And I'll object for discussion purposes. Questions on the CS. First, I would like to make a couple of comments. And I think that the original, as Mr. Grusendorf stated, the original bill as presented to us was in the neighborhood of $205 million. And we are approving in this CS $172,816,800, but there is an increase in general funds of $4,150,738,800. The vast majority of this appropriation is, as was presented, savings to the
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think it's billions?
Billion, yeah, billions.
Billions.
Billions. Excuse me. $2.6 billion. And to the CBR, the CBR currently has, that represents a payment of 50% of the outstanding balance that the state of Alaska owes to the CBR. So this would leave still a balance of $2.6 billion that is owed to the CBR. There currently exists, I believe, $3.3 billion. Is that correct?
It's pretty close.
In the fund, so this would bring the fund balance of the CBR to $5.9 billion, and if the trends continue in the next couple of years, mm-hmm. it's conceivable that the state of Alaska could completely repay the CBR off if revenues or the prices of oil stay high. The other one here is a deposit to the statutory budget reserve that just requires, for the members, requires only a simple majority, and that is $1 billion. The other items in this fast track is the $18.5 billion that wasn't mentioned that is needed in the fast track to ensure that the seniors receive their benefits on the legislation that the legislature passed during the special session. I think it's imperative that we've been informed by the administration that there may be cash flow problems, and that is why we are proceeding with this $18.5 billion in the fast track so that services will not be disrupted. We've heard a lot about the high energy costs in the state of Alaska, and we've heard that the two programs that were outlined by Mr. Grusendorf, we're putting aside $300 million in this legislation to try to make sure that we give the opportunity in a grant program and a loan program to ensure that individuals in the state of Alaska can at least improve the efficiencies of their homes so that they will be less dependent upon the quantity of oil. This hopefully will save Alaskans throughout Alaska the amount that they're spending in their household budget. Again, the other major change is $150 million in the in front end loading the revenue sharing bill that is currently in the House. The Senate had passed it last year, and we fully anticipate that piece of legislation will pass this year, and that appropriation is contingent on passage of Senate Bill 72. The hearers list was explained, and if Senator Stedman can address the capital appropriation of $50 million.
The
placeholder.
Right. Just for clarity, to make sure I understand what you're saying, Mr. Chairman, and everybody's clear. You're talking about putting $3.6 billion into savings.
That's correct.
On this bill. $300 into energy.
Yes.
Conservation. Not a dividend check to everybody, but conservation. And then $150 million into revenue sharing for our communities.
That's correct. That front-end loading a program that will produce a program to ensure a three-year life of a $50 million program each year.
And then there's also $18.5 million to deal with some our seniors so they don't run out.
That's correct.
Okay. That's a hard thing to follow up with, Mr. Chairman. We also have the placeholder of the $50 million that the co-chair had mentioned for dealing with capital appropriations that were submitted to the administration and were rejected or vetoed. It's a substantially lower dollar amount than the original veto items by well over 50%. We're rushing with the 90-day session, so we're still working on that process of those capital items. So over the next few days, we'll be flushing those out, and we're scrubbing that list. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Again, I think Alaskans wanted to be ensured that we would not spend all of the major surplus that we are truly blessed with this year, this fiscal year that we're in. And that is why we are proposing to set aside the $3.6 billion in savings. Alaskans are concerned about energy costs, and I believe this is a major first step to ensure that Alaskans can at least take the initiative to weatherize their homes. And I believe that this is a package that Alaskans will embrace. It is a major increase to what the administration has proposed in the original supplemental, but I think it's a major step in the right direction. Further questions on the proposed CS? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The resolution of the hatchery situation, of course, that predates my time, but my understanding is that the hatcheries were agreed to, and it was based on, obviously, the funding was a bonding paid by license fees, and the amounts have gone up. Cost overruns are not an unusual situation in this day and time, and of course, delaying any projects doesn't serve much purpose other than to increase that situation. I'm not sure why the language as it reads now says that the enabling language to expend money in Fairbanks is cut off, leaving the hatchery for Anchorage in the appropriation language, which concerns me. I know there's been some letters exchanged with the governor regarding their support for it, and I understand we'd like to get the governor engaged on this particular issue, but I believe that this is not the way to approach that. I would suggest that if we were going to do anything, that we would split the money, as was understood, that even though they're two different cost projects, that at least if the money were split fairly, we would then engage both the Anchorage and the Fairbanks delegation discussions with the governor on how we solve a problem, rather than just simply doing away with the money that would be the appropriation for the Fairbanks hatchery, which is underway now. Holes dug, compacted, site prep work pretty much done, well drilled. Utilities at least brought to the site, so this does not seem to me to be a fair resolution of the situation. So I would hope that we could seek some kind of better solution to this one.
I appreciate your comments, and I'm sure that we will have a full debate upon that before the passage of this legislation. Further questions? Thank you, Senator Thomas.
Thank you. I'd appreciate it if Senator Stedman would reiterate the remarks about items that were vetoed out of last year's capital budget and what our intentions are on that.
Senator Stedman?
Last year there was, and I don't have the total list in front of me, well over $100 million that were vetoed out of the capital budget, and as there was some concern that there wasn't as good of information as some people would have liked on some projects. There was also some I think some miscommunication concerning that issue between the legislative branch and the administrative branch, which led to the outcome, which I feel is an inadvertent outcome. I don't think the goal here at this table is to submit items to any governor for veto. It's nice to work together and agree on what's in there as we go forward. So that list is being scrubbed, and which is another way of saying it's being reviewed by my office, being substantially reduced into the target range of about $50 million to try to bring these projects that were requested by the local municipalities, approved by the councils and the assemblies, and brought to the legislature, which is the elected appropriating body, to advance these needed items at the local level. There is no intent to put on the table the entire group of vetoes, but a substantially reduced list. Again, this is dealt with the 08 capital budget. And for the people at home that are watching, and when we're talking about $3.6 billion in savings, this is the revenue that the state is collecting this current fiscal year that ends at the end of June. We're hoping in the next budget cycle, which we're working on now, the 09, that we will have additional savings coming to the Treasury. But as we advance our liquidity position, increasing our savings, we still want to move forward with our infrastructure, taking care of our seniors and our children, make sure that they have things to do other than inadvertently go astray when they're younger. So there's some social issues that we need to address across the state along with our capital needs. So we'll be working with DOT and other departments in the times of good revenue to advance some of the larger projects and the smaller projects while we take the opportunity to substantially improve our liquidity.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, more specifically, and I appreciate those remarks, but more specifically, are we talking about putting some of the vetoed projects into the supplemental budget at this table, next few days, and particularly in this document that's before us?
It's still, Mr. Chairman, it's still a work in progress. So we're working on that. It could very well be itemed in this document or, at the other body. I mean, it's got to come in. If they're going to go in, unless there's only two committees are going to go in at, either this one or the other finance committee. So that's a work in progress.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Dyson?
Yeah.
Follow-up?
I think I heard is maybe, but I want to be clear that this is not the document that we've accepted here as working before us does not have any of the vetoed projects in it.
That's correct.
And secondly, it appears to me this administration is trying to bring a increased integrity to the whole budgeting process, and particularly the supplementals. And in years past, I've been uncomfortable when we have mixed supplemental budgets and kind of bastardized the process by mixing budget items across the fiscal year barrier. And when we have put what ought to be capital budgets into the supplemental and mixed the capital and operating budgets. And I appreciate the intention here to not lose the next construction season and to get things going forward, but I am uncomfortable about mixing goats and sheep in a singular document. That's all. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for those comments, but that practice has been around many times and has been followed even when you were in the majority on a consistent basis, Senator Dyson.
May we have a brief, Eddies?
Mr. Donahue. Come back to order.
Mr. Chairman?
Before you make your comment, I would like to say that we are not crossing fiscal years, I believe, in most of these appropriations. These are basically '08 projects, but Senator Stedman?
Just to make it clear to everybody on the table, there's a $50 million placeholder in the bill. The capital items that were being discussed, the vetoes is not, the vetoed items are not individually listed as yet. We're working on that. Okay. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, just a comment on the cross years. We have the last 2 years that the co-chairman and myself have worked together at this table, we've been trying to get more transparency into this system, and we're going to continue to do so. I personally believe that we should have the smallest supplemental budgets as possible, but when we deal with a budget cycle where we have to put in place a budget a couple of months before the fiscal year starts, there's going to be problems 6 to 9 months into it that we need to address to have a smooth running state. But we need to be careful when we look at the supplemental budgets that we take a look at the operating impacts and we don't get caught up in the pure dollar amounts of the supplemental. Otherwise, we would look at the dollar amount of this supplemental, which is in the billions, and it would drop us right out of our chair as far as the dollar amounts we're dealing with. So I just urge the committee members to concentrate some effort in looking at the impact on the agencies so we get as accurate of budget as we can when we implement it in the spring, and then the smallest supplemental. And I also agree that we should be very careful when we're doing capital projects in the supplemental, and we are getting away from the crossing fiscal years. The concentration for the next year's budget cycle, 09, is to have all of 09 funded out of 09's revenue stream plus savings.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. And remember, I'm an old fisherman, not an economic expert. But it seems to me then what I just heard is that the $50 million placeholder in this document before us is indeed for capital projects, some of which were out of the vetoed list.
Specifically to the vetoed list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then I was confused by what I understood your response to be, and that the when you said front-end loading, I think the weatherization project, which I appreciate and applaud, we were indeed funding for years out in the future, which does cross the fiscal line barrier. So do I understand that correctly?
It's a supplemental for the capital projects, existing programs to expand existing programs in the future. Just as, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
And with that, I would invite the OMB Director Karen Rayfield to have any initial comments at this time if she so desires. She's indicating she does not want to have any comments at this time. I would like to state before we put this on the table for later consideration, it is my intent to have this legislation expedited as quickly as possible. One other note, the total savings, if this bill gets implemented, between the CBR, the SBR, and the funds that we currently have in the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve account will total in excess of $11.5 billion. So that is a substantial amount of funds that are will be sitting in accounts that would be available for the legislature. With that, if there are no other comments, we will set this piece of legislation aside, and we'll take it at ease while we prepare for the rest of the bill. So final comments?
Just a final comment to the people at home that are listening. As referenced earlier a few minutes ago by the chairman, if we take out earnings reserve account, we're at about $7 billion after the spill's in place in savings. We're running about a $4 billion operating account, gives us about almost two years of total operating revenue. So we are making huge steps forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any objections to the adoption of the CS at this time? Seeing none, the CS is adopted. With that, we'll take a brief at ease.
Go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. We have two bills on the agenda, the rest of the agenda. House Bill 13, Retirement System Liability Bonds. We're going to talk about that. I have some more information for the committee members, and then we're going to set that bill aside as we continue to work on that, along with our fiscal planning, our fiscal structure bill. And then we're going to go to Senate Bill 229, Tennenaw Valley Forest, Minto Flats Refuge, and see what the committee wishes to do with that bill at the end, depending on how the presentations and information flow to the committee. With that, we'll go ahead and pick up for the second hearing, House Bill 13. And we will have a kind of an updated presentation by the bill sponsor and the Department of Revenue. We're going to take some invited testimony, and then we're going to have discussions or answer questions. And with that, Representative Hawker, if you can introduce yourself for the record, and then take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Representative Mike Hawker, representing District 32. We sincerely thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 13, continue the presentation of House Bill 13. As folks recall, House Bill 13 would authorize the state to engage in pension financing transactions that ultimately can reduce the cost that we are going to incur to fully fund our pension liabilities. With me today is, again, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, Brian Andrews. What we'd like to do with your, if it serves the pleasure of the committee, Mr. Chair, is sort of have a Brian, at our previous testimony, we ran up against the Senate floor schedule. Like to have a chance to sort of a brief recap his concluding remarks from the previous meeting, and then I believe the testimony that will be provided today from other professionals, investment bankers and other professionals, is really intended here to provide the committee the opportunity to question very knowledgeable, competent, experienced professionals, and our desire is to continue to build your comfort and confidence in this concept as a viable part of Alaska's fiscal planning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, honorable members. For the record, my name is Brian Andrews, Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Revenue. Last time I gave a description of pension obligation bonds, or POBs, I offered some reasons as to why we should consider issuing them, what the risks are associated with a POB transaction, what the potential savings that may be achieved from a POB issuance, and why POBs are issued as taxable debt as opposed to tax-exempt debt. I'll be brief this morning, but I would like to highlight certain points on each one of these topics that we talked about last time. The mechanics of a POB transaction is relatively simple. What a POB transaction tries to accomplish is the replacement of an existing debt obligation with another form of debt which has a lower cost. The concept is the same as refinancing your home mortgage at a lower interest rate. In my testimony, I noted that the 2006 actuarial report points out that the state has an $8.6 billion unfunded liability, in other words, a debt that it owes to the state's pension plan. The debt carries a cost of 8.25%. 2 weeks ago, we obtained some pricing from three major investment banking institutions for a POB transaction. It was determined that a deal could be done for 5.25%. The difference between 8.25% and 5.25% is 3%. That 3% savings over 25 years and $1 billion represents $23 million a year, or $323 million over 25 years, discounted back at a 5% rate. Let me say that the debt markets are currently exhibiting a lot of instability. Whether a deal could be done at 5.25% today is questionable, but I'm confident that a transaction can be done between 5.25% and 5.75%. We are in the lowest interest rate environment that we've seen in the past 40 years. In fact, the 10-year Treasury today, I think, is trading around the 360s area and has only been lower 3.9% of the time in the past 20 years. The secret, if there is one, to a POB transaction is to do it at the lowest cost possible. If we take the proceeds of a POB transaction and invest them with an earnings rate greater than our cost, we're better off for doing the transaction. If we earn something less than our cost, we've made a bad deal. As I pointed out in the testimony a couple weeks ago, over the past 16 years, there's only 2 years, if we had engaged in a POB transaction, 2000 and 2001, which we would have experienced a negative situation with the POB transaction. And I believe I sent letters out showing the cash flows of that, and I think that those are in your packets. But you have to remember that we really don't know how a POB transaction will end up until the POBs are finally paid off, and typically that's a 25-year scenario. There are two other risks I talked about, political risk and market risk. Political risk is simply the risk of overfunding the pension plans and increasing the benefits. And market risk is nothing more than the timing of the market and what kind of investments we so choose. With that, let me go back to the savings matrix that we showed, and then I'll conclude from that. But I wanted to run you through this again, and wanted to point out that in the PERS, you'll see in this corner here the annual contribution rate of 35%. Okay? That's an average of all the participants in the PERS plans today.
Brian, could I get you not to use the pointer?
Oh, sure. On the top horizontal row, you'll see various POB bond transactions and what that will do to the contribution rate. If we did a $2 billion POB, you'll see that the contribution rate goes from 35% down to 32.91%. If you drop to the lower left matrix, you'll see that that's a savings of 2.31%. Doesn't sound like much, but if you then convert that over to dollars in the right column, you'll see that that's an annual savings of $38.62 million. And over the 25-year life, that savings grows to $544 million, and that's again considering a 5% discount rate. Now, what's unique about these matrices is that it also talks about cash. And if you go to the vertical column, you'll see what cash can do to that contribution rate. For example, you can see if we did $2 billion in cash to the PERS system to take down the unfunded liability, the contribution rate drops from 35 down to 23%, a savings of 11.42, or $191 million a year, compounding out over 25 years, discounted back at 5% of $2.6 or $2.7 billion. So the point here is that you can run these matrices, you can look at a combination of debt and cash, but cash is without question the best asset to use in paying down that unfunded liability. You want to talk about that? Oh, the again, with these matrix, we used a 5.25% cost of debt, and also this is based upon a level percent of pay, which the board adopted last fall. I know we have a lot of, or some testimony behind this, so let me then go to the conclusions again, and the conclusions that I would like to point out one final time is that as long as we can earn more than the cost of the POBs, we are better off for issuing them. We are in a very favorable interest rate environment. Let's take advantage of it. Risks associated with POB issuances are quantifiable and statistically justified by the rewards. And doing nothing, in other words, is not a viable option. The best option, of course, is to pay the debt down with cash. If we can't do that, a combination of cash and debt. If we can't do that, debt. But not doing anything is not a good option. So with those brief comments, I'm open for questions, Mr. Chairman.
For, Senator Thomas and Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd appreciate a new page 27 and 28. Mine is pretty hard to read. I'm not sure why that is. Most of the rest of the presentation is fine, but for some reason these numbers are all very, very difficult to read. I'm not sure what the printer did, some problem. So other than that, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to ask if I could get some new ones of those.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I'll make sure you get some new pages.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, the pension obligations are taxable bonds.
Yes.
and that other bonds we, the state might issue for construction projects are not. And I would enjoy a kind of a short course here on how the market views taxable as opposed to non-taxable bonds. And then if, you know, someone who is a lot smarter than me, probably in your league, said that maybe we ought not to issue bonds for the debt, but indeed issue bonds for our construction projects because they're so much more attractive because they're not taxable. So I didn't enjoy how the market responds to that and what criteria we as policymakers ought to be thinking about as we make a choice about those sorts of things.
Through
please, sir.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson. The state, municipalities, political entities have the power under the Internal Revenue Code to issue tax-exempt bonds.
Right.
Okay. But one of the things that the IRS guards very closely is that you can't use an earnings arbitrage with that tax-free status. So if a political entity wants to issue bonds for capital projects, okay, then they can enjoy that tax-exempt status. Remember these bonds, because we're trying to earn a or get an investment arbitrage, would then go off as taxable bonds. And so people that buy those bonds would have to include their earnings in their income. Consequently, they are marketed at a higher rate than the tax-exempt bonds because
right.
of the earnings aspect to the income. Now, Devin and I have looked at various ways of maybe using some tax-exempt strategies with these bonds, but the risk that would be imposed upon the state at this point is too great, plus the capital project amounts that we've looked at are not sufficient enough to do a $2 billion plus deal.
Can you please pull your mic closer to
you? Oh.
Follow up, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, so investors and large managers of funds, I think they generally are attracted to tax-exempt bonds, as I understand it, particularly ones that are backed by somebody that's got $40 billion bucks in the bank. But indeed, if we, instead of putting a lot of money into capital projects, bonded for those and took the money we were going to put into those capital projects and paid down debt, you know, on the per STIRS liability, we could probably do ourselves some good. What's wrong with that strategy?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, again, you cannot connect the dots. In other words, you can't take money that you kind of, with a wink and a nod, say, this is really going to be for taking down the unfunded liability, and then try and get the tax-free benefit out of that. Again, the IRS would look very dimly at that transaction.
Let me just clarify that a little bit, because and maybe help Senator Dreisner, because maybe the point of his question is being lost. We have the ability, if we so choose, to issue bonds to do capital projects of, say, $1 billion, a round number,
mm-hmm.
rather than doing, say, $4 billion or $5 billion in pension obligation bonds. We do $4 billion in pension obligation bonds, $1 billion. We go out and we go after our capital projects, but you know, so it's not an all or nothing, I think, is what he's trying to ask. And have you reviewed that, and do you have any comments on that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, as long as there isn't a physical connection, in other words, you go out, you do the capital projects bonds, okay. And that frees up an additional $1 billion in your budget, and you want to take that $1 billion and pay down the unfunded liability, you'll be fine.
And so if we can erase all tapes of this conversation and make sure the IRS never gets a hold of them, we're home and free.
You just can't make the connection between the two.
But that is a policy decision, is, you know, that we'll make here at the table, and we recognize that the issue of a direct connection, but I don't really think there is one. We're going to be looking at potential bonding for capital projects over the next couple of months also.
And Senator Stedman, thank you, and I'd just like to emphasize this point as well, that you know, as large and diverse an entity as the state of Alaska is, and as large and diverse as our fiscal participation and requirements are, there is definitely a place and a role in the state's financial management portfolio for both tax-exempt debt for specific projects and debt such as this that would be specifically targeted to those reductions of the pension liabilities. Commissioner Andrews pointed out, there would be, you know, the Internal Revenue Service would look at the weight of evidence, and if we had suddenly embarked upon a $2 or $3 billion capital debt program and at the same time put those significant amounts of money into the pension plan, even if we didn't connect the dots, it wouldn't take lawyers very long to suggest the dots were connected. However, again, a balanced program across the state of differing types, sorts of debt, such as we currently have with, say, debt at Alaska Housing Finance, significant amounts of debt there, targeting those programs is absolutely acceptable, because we can, that's very clearly allowed for government instrumentalities to both have savings, have investments, and have tax-exempt debt. So, but again, this is all part of putting a tool in front of us that allows the state of Alaska, the Department of Revenue, the widest possible latitude in taking us into the future in the most cost-effective manner.
On the issue of the rating and the rate that we're going to have to pay on our bonds, Mr. Andrews, can you address the state's bond rating and just use S&P as an example so we don't get the confusion of all the different rating agencies and all the different alphabet soup that everybody uses?
Okay.
So, and then how the pension obligation bonds are normally issued relative to that rating?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The state currently has a AA, what we call flat rating, or depending on the scale you're using, it can be granulated to a 2, but it's a AA neutral. And then each credit rating has 1, 2, and 3 according to it. Earlier this week, we were out in New York talking to the rating agencies, asking them for an upgrade to our credit rating to a AA1. And there's just to be very brief about that, there's a lot of financial strengths that we're exhibiting now that should warrant us a credit rating increase. Because these POBs are appropriation-type bonds, they're not general obligation bonds, meaning that each year the legislature has to appropriate for the debt service of these bonds, the ratings typically carry on the POBs one notch below the state's general obligation rating. So in this case, because we're AA neutral, these POBs would be a AA minus or a AA 3.
On that subject?
Yeah, I just got a follow-up on that. Could you bring back to the committee an expectation in today's market of the issuance of $1 billion, you can just pick a number, on AA, what that would be as a marginal increase cost to the state if the bonds were issued at the AA minus, one notch under the AA? And I'd like to get an estimate of that in dollars. And just as for informational purposes for the committee members, we are working, and one of the issues is a supplemental that was on this table, the previous bill, the substantial savings, $3.6 billion being set aside. there's language being worked on for the physical structure bill that will better enable the rating agencies to recognize some of our savings and our planning process to try to push our rating up, and not up temporarily, but push it up legitimately, which will then hopefully lower the cost of this debt, which is going to be substantial if we issue $4 or $5 billion in pension obligation bonds. So it's one part of the puzzle. There's just want to remind everybody that there's several pieces moving around the table at the same time. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Slightly off subject, and I'd appreciate just a little bit of latitude here. I've been asking the question, what is a appropriate level of debt for an enterprise our size with the volatility of the income stream? What's a proper appropriate level of debt for us to carry? And, you know, one of the answers that comes back is, well, a level of debt that likes the bond rating people like. And hence my earlier comment, you know, they like us because we got $40 billion in the bank, but we sitting at this table know that it would be very, very dire circumstances when we ever got into the principal, you know, to pay off debt. And we don't see that as liquid assets that we can use to pay off debt, certainly in my lifetime, maybe in yours. And but what is a rule of thumb for a public body like ours to carry as a level of debt compared to either our budget, our assets, or our gross state product? Any ideas, sir?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson. First of all, let me make a couple comments. The state of Alaska is very unique to the other 49 states. The tools that the rating agencies look to and measure us really don't work. You take a look at revenue per capita and a lot of their other measurement tools, they really don't make a lot of sense because we're so dependent upon oil as a revenue. Let me also make the comment that in a POB transaction, it doesn't impact the state's AA rating. Okay, the rating agencies consider that neutral, even though those bonds would go out a notch below. Now, to answer your question succinctly, we probably have an additional capacity for debt, general obligation debt, or COPs, of about $1.5 billion.
Hey, we're going to take a brief Eddie's.
And what happens?
Back on record, we're going to take an at ease at 10:30. I would recommend that we try to give a succinct and brief answers to the questions. We'll continue to work on this as we move forward. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody else but me is interested in that answer, and I can get it offline and not take our time.
Issue of how much debt can the state carry?
Yeah, and I'm not interested in how much debt we can carry without the bond rating outfits not liking us. I'm interested in what is a prudent level for us to think about as we try to conservatively look after the state's affairs, knowing that that $40 billion is off limits in general. So it's a different kind of question, but related.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, I think all of us are interested in that answer. So, you know, I think all of us should be interested in what the debt levels are. We should be quite concerned if we approach that those levels. So,
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the context of the bill that is before the committee, this issue of appropriate or reasonable debt levels, we have to be mindful, and I would point to folks, again, the book we handed out earlier from the ORIC Corporation, Evaluating Bonded Debt, and the Standard & Poor's analysis that we also passed out the previous meeting. It is important to realize that in the context of this bill, the rating agencies, the world, even ourselves, we have an $8.5 billion debt, and it is this sort of a bond issuance is not viewed, and as I cite the ORIC reference book, because POBs replace existing pension obligations, they are not generally viewed as adding to the debt burden of a state or local government issuer. So to that end, actually structuring our debt, making the firm commitment to pay it off, can actually enhance the state's credit rating or the view in the capital credit markets with formalizing these debts.
There was a letter sent, everybody got CC February 15th, showing some cash flow analysis standards. Could you add a few more columns to that when you bring that information back, showing the payments that we are assuming under Senate Bill 125, which is the cost share bill concerning retirement system, both the public and the teachers, so we could see the total cash flow impact as we flow across, because we have to pay that obligation when we pick it up from the schools and the cities. If you had, I'd appreciate that. Do we have other questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm surprised at, on slide 8, I'm surprised at the adjustment that has to be made for the net present value of savings over the 25-year period of time, but I'm assuming that's just a standard percentages attached to that, because obviously the 25 years at 23 million is 575 million, but the net present value, I guess, adjustment is a 252 million reduction is what it amounts to over that time. So, but
well, through the chair, Senator Thomas, there is a time value to money.
Sure,
and that's what you're seeing there reflected.
Larger than I thought. Thank you, though.
Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, we're going to check the clock. We've got about 20 minutes. So we're going to start with the folks online. Jeff Urbina from Wachitovia, if you could identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, for the record, this is Jeff Urbina, Vice President of Investment Banking for Wachovia Securities. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am the Vice President of Investment Banking for Wachovia Securities. Wachovia has three offices within the state of Alaska. I work out of the Seattle office at 520 Pike Street in downtown Seattle. Wachovia Securities was the number one ranked underwriter for municipal bonds in the state of Alaska for 2007. Bankers at Wachovia have been providing investment banking services to the state of Alaska for the past 33 years. I wanted to thank the committee for inviting our firm to testify on behalf of House Bill 13 regarding the potential issuance of pension obligation bonds for the state's unfunded pension liability, which is synonymous with UAL or UAAL, as was presented by Deputy Commissioner Andrews in his presentation. All of us testifying today have similar experience with regard to other state and local issuers of pension obligation bonds. We have been involved in pension obligation bonds in Oregon, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Connecticut, New Jersey, as well as many other states for both local and state issuers. As others have acknowledged throughout this whole process, pension obligation bonds is only one alternative or tool for the state to use in order to address its unfunded pension liability. It is important to acknowledge that other issuers will most likely differ in their funding mix, funding ratio, and ultimately structure of their pension obligation bonds. Comparing the state of Alaska to many of its peers may be helpful in a broad analysis, but many factors play into these decisions, and ultimately the state will need to come up with its own solution. For the majority of the POBS programs or POB programs that we have been involved in, we have focused our evaluation on three silos, or more simply, a three-legged stool approach. The first leg of the stool is a programmatic evaluation, program structure, contributions, and program assumptions, and also tiering. The second leg is the actuarial assumption analysis, which includes demographic information, mortality tables, a number of other actuarial assumptions. The third leg is the evaluation of actuarial investment pool earnings. This is by investment segment, historical trends, and projections. Our clients have used this three-legged stool approach in order to appropriately frame the solution to their respective unfunded pension liabilities. In most cases, the solution has included the issuance of pension obligation bonds to some degree. We believe the process of issuing pension obligation bonds can best be viewed not as a cure, but as an option to fund the state's unfunded liability, and is really a tool. The goal of this process, obviously, is to lower the cost of the existing debt to plan participants of the state's pension programs. We have had a lot of success in issuing pension obligations over the years for both state and local issuers. In closing, we believe that the state of Alaska, with a well-thought-out program using pension obligation bonds, will also be successful in dealing with this unfunded pension obligation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'd open it or send it back to the Chair Stedman for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to go on to Richard Schober. If you can please identify yourself and who you represent. And I see there's two people from your firm, so I would just assume you pick one and do your delivery, please.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm going to defer to my colleague, Carol Samuels, to make our presentation.
Okay.
Morning, everyone. My name is Carol Samuels. I'm a Senior Vice President with Seattle Northwest Securities, and I'm based in our Oregon office. Representative Hawker has asked us to focus our attention this morning on the Oregon story, if you will. Oregon has a system that is actually not all that dissimilar from Alaska's system, and having been through bond issuance in a fairly significant way, perhaps there are some lessons that you can take away from that. Just a little background, Oregon's system is about four times the size of Alaska's. At the end of 2002, there was an estimate presented by the state's actuary that the unfunded liability had reached $17 billion. So as a consequence, the state undertook in similar ways to Alaska's legislature to provide some legislative changes to the system. Those took place in the 2003 legislative session. Our legislature meets every other year. And that, I would say, reduced the unfunded liability by about 50%. Simultaneously, many jurisdictions undertook the issuance of unfunded liability bonds, pension obligation bonds, if you will, including the state itself. The state issued bonds in 2003 to the tune of $2 billion. This was following a vote by the general public. It was subject to voter approval because they issued general obligation bonds, and it received a 55% voter approval rate. So they went ahead and they issued the $2 billion. In addition, local governments in our state, which have issuance authority on an individual basis, have also made use of this tool to the tune of about $3 billion. And thus far, the results have all been very, very positive. At the outset of the issuance, we ran all of our estimates on the basis of an 8% rate of return, which is the rate of return that our actuary uses. That's in contrast to the 8.25% that's used in Alaska. And estimated that savings on the overall issuance of about $5 billion would be about 25% of that, or about $1.4 billion. But since issuance began, and each bond issue has a slightly different return based upon the time it was issued, we have a chart which indicates that the highest rate of return for those that have issued, say, in 2002 was over 20%, and that's through the end of 2007. Now, obviously, as an arbitrage play, there are pluses and there are minuses, and over the course of the past month, I'm sure you've all witnessed in your own personal financial portfolios that the returns have been much more negative than that. But as a long-term state of being, being in a position where we've had very, very strong returns since 2002, in excess of 20% in some cases, puts our issuance in very strong footing going forward. Many of these bond issues were sold at interest rates very similar to what you'd see today. Some of them were issued at much higher rates. We actually had one issue that was sold at a 7% rate. And despite that higher than average rate for the subsequent issues, it has still returned overall on an annualized basis about 15%. So good shape for that. In terms of specific takeaway lessons that I would share with you in pursuing a bond issuance program, the first is that the structure of the financing really matters.
Ms. Samuels, can I get you to wrap up, please? We're dealing with the clock issue here.
I'm sorry. I would just say that it's important to structure your issue carefully and also to make sure that at the administrative level at PERS, there is a understanding about how the bond proceeds will be invested, because to the extent you use this tool, you're going to be sending them a lot of cash all at one time. And with that, I will offer myself up for any questions you might have. Thank you for the opportunity.
We do have your presentation from your firm in our packet.
Great. Thank you.
Adam Stoll in the House.
Hello, Chairman. My name is Adam Stoll. I'm a vice president from Goldman Sachs. I run our pension liability finance business nationally, and thank you for having me here today. I will be very brief. We have included a brief presentation that I believe is in your packets, and I won't go through it all today, knowing we're pressed for time, but we'll be available for any questions. Really, we're here to make the point that pension obligation bonds are a very common tool used by governments. Since 2001, there have been over $30 billion in pension obligation bond issuances. Recently, there was a Standard & Poor's report out last month that said pension obligation bonds have been popular with issuers and successful for sponsors. So they are used in a widespread way. Over 20 states have issued pension obligation bonds, and they have generally performed very well. We are currently in a very low interest rate environment, which makes pension obligation bonds a useful tool for government to use in that type of environment, and can create great savings for the state of Alaska over a period of time. There are several, on page two of the presentation we presented, we showed three examples of pension obligation bond issuances in the past: the state of Oregon, which was just discussed, the state of Illinois, and the state of New Jersey. And the only point I want to make there is that, as you can see, the interest cost on those three issuances varies greatly, with the state of New Jersey issuing with a total interest cost of well over 7%. When an issuance is done with a high issuance cost in that way, the chance for the arbitrage to occur and take place with your investments is less. And so in an environment like this, And in addition, with the bill, HB 13, specifically prohibiting the issuance of pension obligation bonds unless the investment rate of return is 150 basis points above the total interest cost, is a very prudent measure to include in the bill and can be very successful for the state. I will leave it at that. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Oh, we got a question from Senator Thomas, and we do have your presentation in our packet. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I notice on your presentation, page one, extreme amount of activity in 2002 through 2005. Is there some explanation for that? Is that a reaction to what took place with the stock market in 99, 2000?
Yes. Unfunded liabilities grew greatly in those early years of 2000, 2001, 2002, and so there were a number of large issuances that occurred in particularly 2003, as you see, where Illinois issued due to low returns in those previous years.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Greg Sundberg. And the clock ticks, so.
Mr. Chairman and honorable members of the committee, my name is Greg Sundberg. I'm managing director with Merrill Lynch. And due to the tight clock and being in the wrap-up position, I'm not going to make a presentation. What I'd like to say is we've been working with a variety of people in the state of Alaska over the course of the last 4 years in examining every detail related to this legislation and answering questions, serving as a resource. And we think it's been vetted on numerous occasions. We think it is a good tool, reinforce what others said. It is not the answer, but it's a good tool, and the timing remains good. So we think you've done an extremely good job of moving this forward and doing it in a very prudent fashion. So any questions that you have, I'd love to be able to answer. I know there were questions earlier related to credit markets and rating agency perspective, but anything else that you have, be delighted to answer.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
Let the bill sponsor come forward. Any, do you have any comments and wrap up before we set this aside and continue to work on this?
Mr. Chairman, I believe you've heard a very competent body of testimony. That this is a prudent measure for the state to undertake, and certainly all of those folks who've offered professional testimony, as well as the folks in the Department of Revenue, are available at any time for any member of the committee who would like to gain a further comfort level with this proposal. With that, sir, I thank you very, very kindly for the continued hearing and consideration of this bill.
And you could, Rep. Parker, maybe work with Revenue on expanding their cash flow analysis and bring that back at a later date.
And Senator Stedman, Mr. Chairman, very much. We will work with your staff, if it's all right with you, to make sure that what response you get is exactly what you're looking for.
Okay, thank you. Any final comments? We've been called to a caucus here at 10:30. Looks like the schedule's been truncated. Senator Thomas, your bill was scheduled to be next.
It was.
So we'll bring that up at the beginning of our next meeting, if that's all right with you.
That'll be fine. Thank you.
That meeting adjourned.